You're listening to LawPod UK. It's a podcast brought to you by the barristers of One Crown Office Row, and it covers all aspects of civil and public law in the UK. All comments are current at the time of publication, and this episode is presented by me, Lucy McCann. On the 14th of February this year, the Divisional Court ruled that the prescription of Palestine Action as a terrorist organisation was unlawful. This decision is of huge significance to the government and the credibility of its counter-terror regime, to the state of policing in the UK, and it's of legal significance. The judgment grapples with pressing issues such as the balance of rights under the convention and the latitude afforded to government decision makers. And also, of course, it's a decision of huge significance to the wider public, many of whom have been caught up in this decision. I'm sure our listeners are familiar with the background to this case, but just briefly, on the 20th of June, members of Palestine Action broke into RAF Brize-Norton. They sprayed red paint into turbines of two of the aircraft there and attacked the aircrafts with crowbars and sprayed paint onto the runway symbolising bloodshed. Shortly thereafter, on the 5th of July, Palestine Action were prescribed under the Terrorism Act. According to Amnesty International, as at the 11th of December 2025, over 2,700 arrests have been carried out across the UK, many of those peacefully protesting against genocide in Gaza. Of those arrests, approximately 254 protesters have been charged. The cost to the public purse has been estimated in the sum of £10 million, specifically for policing, and some juries now seem unwilling to convict members of Palestine Action. So with that background in mind, I'd like to welcome back our listeners after a short period of hibernation and to welcome back John Metzer, fellow barrister at One Crown Office Row, to discuss this case.
Thank you very much for having me. I think this is the unfinished business from the round case has been handed down. It's great to be here to talk about it.
And I'm sure the business will continue into the year. So I'm sure there'll be plenty of updates that we can give our listeners as and when we get more news. So John, let's start by looking more generally about powers under the Terrorism Act and specifically about prescribing organisations under it. So other organisations that have been prescribed under the Act include Al-Qaeda, Hezbollah, Al-Shabaab, ISIS, neo-Nazi groups. All of those, I'm sure, are listeners will be familiar with. So before we get into Palestine Action specifically, John, can you explain the basis upon which organisations like these come to be prescribed under the Terrorism Act and the effect that prescription has?
If an organisation is prescribed, then it becomes an offence to belong to it, to invite support for it, to arrange a meeting to support it or to further its activities, or to wear clothing or display in public anything that would arouse a reasonable suspicion that you're a member or supporter of it. And it also becomes an offence to fundraise for it. So it basically makes a banned organisation. And the legal power is under Section 3 of the Terrorism Act of 2000. And that creates a power given to the Home Secretary to prescribe an organisation if she believes the organisation is concerned in terrorism. And terrorism is also defined under the Act at Section 1 as the use or threat of action when that use or threat is designed to influence the government or, relevantly, to intimidate the public or a section of the public, and is made for the purpose of advancing a political, religious, racial or ideological cause. And action is also defined as serious violence against a person and serious damage to property. There are other things as well, but that's what's relevant here.
So what was it specifically about the activities of Palestine Action that the Home Secretary felt she could use her powers under the Act?
Well, the judgment reveals that even before the incident on the 20th of June, the government was considering whether to prescribe this organisation but hadn't reached a decision to do so. And these events were the straw that broke the camel's back. The Home Secretary said that this was done in a context of a nationwide campaign of direct criminal action against businesses and institutions, including key national infrastructure and defence firms. And she said this had been increasing in frequency and severity since the start of 2024, which of course was shortly after the events of October the 7th and the conflict which followed. And the government said that the methods had become more aggressive and the focus had been on Elbit Systems UK, which is a defence company and a subsidy of Israel's largest military manufacturer. Mm. The Home Secretary pointed to an attack against a Jewish-owned business in North London, where the glass front of the building was smashed and the building and floor defaced with red paint, including the slogan, "Drop Elbit."
I think this is interesting. I read commentary from Alan Green, who's a senior counterterrorism researcher, who mentioned that he thought the prescription marked a kind of radical departure from earlier prescriptions. And I'm sure some of our listeners might feel the same. Given the list of organisations that you can see have been prescribed under the Act, it may appear that even with a description of those actions, it kind of sits out with a kind of list of other organisations. And what I found particularly interesting about how the claimants presented their own activities to the Divisional Court and where they thought they sat. So this is discussed in paragraph 21 of the judgment. And there they compare their actions to, for example, Gandhi's campaign against the Indian Salt Act 1882 or the civil rights movement in the United States of America in the 50s and 60s. I don't think any fair evaluation of their activities would suggest that that was true. And of course, the Divisional Court rejected that quite strongly. But I do think there is a range of activities between, for example, the civil rights movement in the US and peaceful protests and sit-ins and acts of terror. And I think, you know, for a lot of our listeners who have been paying close attention to other political activities, for example, those of Extinction Rebellion, where one could describe their targets and activities quite similarly. So, you know, not defense organizations and businesses, but fossil fuel companies and deliberately targeting organizations who associate with them. So museums, cultural organizations, et cetera, and use kind of similarly intimidatory tactics and criminal tactics to place pressure on those organizations to relinquish their links to, for example, the oil industry. I'm not defending those activities, but I do think it's interesting that the Palestine Action sought to kind of place themselves well beyond, I think, any kind of reasonable assessment of what their activities actually were. What do you think, John?
It's a really interesting question. And of course, the wisdom of the decision to prescribe is a matter of politics rather than a matter of law. For my own part, I think it's completely wrong to accuse Israel of genocide when you consider the nature of Hamas and what it did on October the 7th. And when you consider how Hamas embeds itself in civilian areas, that must be a relevant factor to how the war progressed. But in a sense, that's by the by, because it's a choice for the government to make as to whether it considers this organization to be a terrorist group or not. And no doubt you're right that it isn't of the same nature as an organization like Al-Qaeda. I would point out, though, that the court, even though it finds that the prescription was unlawful, and we'll go into the detail, the court is very heavily critical of Palestine Action. It says that it's an organization which, what it refers to as direct action, comprises for the most part various types of criminality, including acts of criminal damage, and it rejected as false the contention that these were acts of protest in that tradition. It says, the court said that the core hallmarks of civil disobedience, namely the objective of seeking a change in the law or government policy, an approach to law breaking that is characterized by restraint and acceptance of the legal consequences of their actions, are emphatically not the hallmarks of Palestine Action's campaign. And the court also notes that even though it's quite right to say that only a small number of instances of action by members of Palestine Action met the threshold for terrorism, it noted that those acts, the organization did not distance itself from them, and it praised those who took part in them. And that seems to me to be of importance, because if they had said, look, we're mortified, this is not us, we don't do this kind of thing, we believe in political protest, then that would feel like a different situation. So I think what the court has said there is really interesting, and we'll look at what it means, because it seems to me that the court has then set out the ingredients of an organisation which is capable of being considered to be a terrorist organisation, even if it isn't the same as organisations which we consider to be classically terrorist in character. And so I think it's going to be interesting to look at that when we look at the detail of the decision.
Okay, so just because an organisation can be proscribed, and we've talked about the activities that Palestine Action have undertaken, which led to that threshold being met in the eyes of the government, it doesn't mean that it necessarily should. Can you explain the discretionary aspect to this and how the Home Secretary should go about exercising her discretion to proscribe?
Yes. So I think this touches on the first ground on which the court found for the claimant. The Home Secretary has a long-standing policy in respect to the exercise of the power, which provides guidance to the effect that if the threshold test for prescription is met, that is, the Home Secretary believes that the organisation is concerned in terrorism, then she needs to consider whether prescription will be proportionate. And when considering that question, the policy says that she will take into account other factors, including five factors in particular. One, the nature and scale of the organisation's activities. Two, the specific threat that it poses to the UK. Three, the specific threat that it poses to British nationals overseas. Four, the extent of the organisation's presence in the UK. And five, the need to support other members of the international community in the global fight against terrorism.
So in this case, the divisional court took issue with the Home Secretary essentially considering another factor, so one that wasn't that set list of five. And specifically, she gave consideration to the operational impact that prescription would have. So in her submission, her view was that it was relevant to consider that prescription would enable operational partners to disrupt Palestine Action's activity and its organisational infrastructure. So prescription would provide law enforcement with additional levers to disrupt Palestine Action's operations, critical infrastructure, operate overtly and use media platforms to project legitimacy and potentially radicalise people to its cause. So the divisional court essentially took issue with the Home Secretary taking into consideration that operational benefit. Can you explain, John, why they took issue with that?
So the court said that it had been appropriate to treat as pertinent the nature and scale of the activities, and that the assessment of those matters was reasonably open to her. And it was also, although only three of Palestine Action's many actions had been assessed as reaching the threshold of acts of terrorism, the court said that she was entitled to attach significant weight to that. But as you rightly say, the court said that the nature of this policy and its purpose is to limit use of the discretionary power to prescribe. And the court conceptualised those five factors as having that effect and held in that context that it was impermissible to consider that prescription would be advantageous, because it would mean, as you explain, that relevant offences could be used against any person supporting the organisation, because that goes outside how the policy is meant to apply and was not a relevant consideration. And so even though latitude is given to the Home Secretary to decide for herself which matters were appropriate other factors, the court said that the operational consequences and advantages of prescription is not a factor consistent with the policy, for the obvious reasons that such consequences and advantages will apply equally to any organisation that could be prescribed.
So you, in your article for the UK Human Rights Blog, John, which I would recommend all listeners read for a more in-depth discussion of the judgment with kind of relevant paragraphs extracted from it, you say that you think this decision is vulnerable to challenge. Can you explain your reasons why?
I hesitate to criticise this judgment. These are three highly respected judges, and it's a carefully reasoned decision, and I'm a junior barrister. But this is my take for what it's worth, and we'll see whether the Court of Appeal thinks I'm right or not. Of course, the Court of Appeal may consider that this decision does survive a challenge, given that there is, of course, latitude afforded to a first instance court. But my take on it is that it isn't right to conceptualize this policy in quite the way that the court does, as being for the purpose of limiting the circumstances under which prescription would be prescribed. I think it's quite conceivable that the Court of Appeal will feel that really what this policy does is just encourages and invites the government to consider all the relevant factors, those that point in favour and those that might point against. And I'm not really sure that all of the five factors do have the limiting effect. So it seems to me, for example, that the fifth factor, the need to support other members of the international community in the global fight against terrorism, I think that in theory, that factor could operate in a permissive way. So, for example, let's say that there is an organisation which is very small in the UK and there isn't really much evidence that it poses a threat to British nationals and its activities in the UK have been very limited, but our NATO allies are dealing with it elsewhere as being an organisation of real significance and threat. Factor five, it seems to me, in a situation like that, which is, of course, completely different from this case, seems to me that that factor could allow the government to place weight on it in a permissive way to say that notwithstanding that some of these factors do not materially point in favour of prescription, this factor broadens those circumstances. So I'm not really sure that the five factors are all have the purpose of limiting. I wonder if the Court of Appeal will see them more as simply being a list of factors which are all relevant rather than all limiting. And so I think it could be, and I would guess that the Court of Appeal will take the view that the approach to the policy was unduly rigid. Of course, I may be completely wrong.
Yeah, that's interesting, John. My reading of it is that I agree that some of those factors could potentially point in favour of prescription, but ultimately they are all capable of being limiting factors. Whereas I do think the operational consideration is one, number one, that will always exist, and it's kind of self-fulfilling thing. You know, of course, the operational benefits of prescribing an organisation will mean that it will be easier to kind of stem its activities and come down hard on its activities. So I think that will always be there and it will always be a limiting factor. And so in that sense, I don't think it is in a similar vein to the other list of factors, which although I think could point in two directions, it's one that on all of them can be weighed up and could be limiting. I think this is of a slightly different quality. So I'm more on the side of the divisional court on this one. And I think it's well worth, when reading your article, to also look at Daniela Locke's article, where she looks at the language of the policy and looks more widely to parliamentary material to consider the purpose of the policy. And she comes down on the side of it being one that is necessarily designed to constrain the use of the Home Secretary's discretion. I think it's one that is wide open for discussion. And I think, as you say, it's certainly territory upon which the Court of Appeal might come to a different view. But yes, for what it's worth, I do agree with the divisional court that the operational consideration is of a different quality to that which is in the policy. But I think that the divisional court implicitly recognised that this is something that could go in the other direction.
Really interesting. And it may well be that you're right. I mean, I hope you'll have me back when we get a judgment appeal. We'll see who is right. Of course, they may go for a third option. There may be a solution to this case, which neither of us have anticipated on that point.
Very possibly. But I do hope that I will go into that next episode with both the weight of the divisional court and the Court of Appeal. You'll have no ground to stand on, John.
You've already got three top judges. But you could have more. We will find out.
We will see. Okay, so let's look at the second ground upon which the divisional court found in favour of Palestine Action. So Palestine Action argued that prescription was a breach of, most importantly for the purposes of our discussion, Articles 10 and 11 of the European Convention. So do you want to explain how the court reached their view that prescription gave rise to very significant interference with those two articles?
Article 10 is the right to freedom of expression, and Article 11 is the right to freedom of assembly and association. And they are, as you can guess, very closely linked and both in play in this case. And the court's reasoning here is really interesting because It says that the case is primarily concerned with the rights of individuals who have not acted unlawfully either before or since prescription, who would have wanted to express support for and associate with Palestine Action, whose stated aim is, quote, to stop genocide and other atrocity crimes by causing disruption to corporate actors who aid, abet, facilitate and profit from those crimes, and who wished to engage in peaceful protests under the banner of Palestine Action, but are stopped from doing so. And these are the people that the court has in mind when it reaches the conclusion that it is disproportionate to have prescribed Palestine Action. The court found that deciding where the balance should be struck in this case is difficult. The court said, to paraphrase, that deciding where the balance should be struck in this case is difficult, that the court should permit some latitude to the Home Secretary, given that she has both political and practical responsibility to secure public safety. Nevertheless, said the court, we are satisfied that the decision to prescribe Palestine Action was disproportionate. At its core, Palestine Action is an organisation that promotes its political cause through criminality and encouragement of criminality. A very small number of its actions have amounted to terrorist action within the definition of Section 1(1) of the 2000 Act.
So, John, again, in your article, you reach the view that you think this is vulnerable to challenge as well, and you take issue with some of the logic here. Can you explain your reasonings?
So the first point is, given the way that Palestine Action is conceptualised, as we've discussed in the judgment, it seems to me that although the court does pay attention to Article 17, I do wonder whether that might be in play in an appeal, because Article 17 under the European Convention provides that nothing in this convention may be interpreted as implying for any state, group or person any right to engage in any activity or perform any act aimed at the destruction of any of the rights and freedoms set forth herein, or at their limitation to a greater extent than is provided for in the convention. And of course, the convention provides for a number of rights, including the right to private life. And we also have the first protocol and Article 1 of that provides for the right to property. And this is a really important part of the ECHR. And I'm a big supporter of the ECHR. And it was framed after the Second World War, essentially as a rejection of both fascism and communism. And it is designed with the thought in mind that a state shouldn't harbour the organisations which might be destructive to a liberal democracy. That's the idea behind Article 17. And I just wonder, given that the court has conceptualised Palestine Action in the way it has, and has said that it's an organisation that is designed to carry out acts of criminality, and they also note that even though it was only a small number of acts that met the threshold for terrorism, Palestine Action had lauded those who took part in them rather than distancing themselves from them. I just wonder whether the Court of Appeal will think that enough attention was paid to Article 17 here, because in the end, I think it could be that the Court of Appeal will wonder, well, the people who want to engage in peaceful protests for entirely legitimate political debate reasons, why does it need to be under the banner of this organisation, given what the Divisional Court has said about the nature of this organisation? And the court also noted that the impact of the prescription will not prevent continuing expressions of support through peaceful protest for the Palestinian cause, or to oppose actions taken by Israel or the Israel Defence Forces. It wouldn't prevent any or all demonstrations targeted at Elbit. And it was not considered that particular forms of protest action were so closely or uniquely associated with Palestine Action that either undertaking such actions or advocating them could properly be considered to be support for Palestine Action. And in that context, I wonder, the finding that there would still be a very significant interference in Article 10 and Article 11, whether the Court of Appeal will look at that and take a different view. And again, I should emphasise it's a carefully reasoned judgment by three very well-respected judges. But I do wonder if on appeal, it may be felt that when you consider the findings as to the nature of the organisation, when you consider the findings as to the impact of prescription, And when you consider the question of whether those people who would wish to engage in peaceful protest could do so under another banner, whether the Court of Appeal may take a different view as to whether prescription was disproportionate. And my guess is that they will. Again, I could be wrong.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because I'm reasonably sympathetic to the argument, you know, what's to stop people who want to protest genocide from doing so under another banner? You know, Palestine Action was set up in 2020. Lots of protest action and other action has been taken against Israel prior to that date. So you don't have to associate yourself with Palestine Action to do so, albeit, of course, you know, since 2020, we have the Israel-Gaza war, which has obviously changed things. But I think that the Divisional Court do grapple with this at paragraph 117 that you referred to, John. So I do think that has formed part of their reasoning. So I'd be interested to see how far the Court of Appeal will defer to that, because they have explicitly acknowledged that that is the case. So it would be very interesting to see what they do with that. I think what's interesting is the comments that the Divisional Court have at 115, 121 and 122. Essentially, they say people can still ostensibly protest as long as they don't associate with Palestine Action. But what they do is say that there has been and will continue to be, not their words, but a chilling effect on those who have been associated with the group or loosely associated with the group, or from those who feel like they could be, even if they've had nothing to do with it. And I think one of the issues that the Divisional Court highlight is that Amori, the claimant, in her statements was very vague about Palestine Action, its membership, its activities. And because of that, I think there is a real concern that journalists, academics, members of the wider public will feel not able to speak up on political issues that they feel keenly about because they're worried about falling within the wider remit of this prescription. And so I think that was kind of the central point for the Divisional Court. But I agree, I think this is one where it is a very finely balanced decision. The Divisional Court recognised that. And although they pay lip service to, I think, affording latitude to the political judgment of the Home Secretary, I think where it is such a finely balanced and difficult decision to make, my view is that historically courts in those circumstances have stepped away from imposing their own view on those things, especially where it's difficult. So I think that could be a kind of more meta or first principles way that the Court of Appeal find against them on that. I don't know what you think.
That had been my guess going into this case. I had guessed that the Divisional Court would reach the conclusion that many people would take different views legitimately on whether this was a wise decision or not, but that it was within the range of reasonable decisions available to the decision maker. Now, of course, I was wrong about that. I may be wrong again. And as you say, the Court of Appeal may say that the Divisional Court demonstrates its consideration of these factors and comes down on one side and decides not to interfere with that. On balance, I think, though, they are more likely to take the view that the reasoning is vulnerable for the reasons that we've discussed. It will be really interesting to look at how they decide it, because this is a fascinating case. It touches, of course, on pressing matters of current affairs, but also it goes to the heart of legitimate protest and where the line is between legitimate and illegitimate protest, which is a question that I think has troubled societies for an extremely long time. So it's a case that feels both very current but also very historic.
I agree. And I think one other way that the Court of Appeal might go about this, and something that I think is really important, is the emphasis that could be placed on other methods that could be used to achieve the operational objectives that the Home Secretary was so concerned about when exercising her discretion under the policy. This is mentioned in the Divisional Court's decision at 139 and elsewhere, namely that when recognising the activities of Palestine Action and those associated with it are very broad, there were a handful of very alarming, significant acts of violence and intimidation and criminal behaviour. In those circumstances, wouldn't it be better to use the criminal law to prosecute those who engaged in those activities rather than prescribe an organisation and run the risk that a number of peaceful protesters and other people that clearly fall on the other side of the line don't get caught up in. I wonder if that might be a better emphasis for the Court of Appeal and for argument before the Court of Appeal.
It's possible. And as you rightly say, that was essentially the alternative measures which the Divisional Court considered to be a serious alternative, because the Divisional Court also considered other possible alternatives but didn't find them to be adequate. So, for example, asset freezes, criminal behaviour orders were not...
Injunctions, things like that.
Yeah, you can't go, you can't expect those affected to seek remedies via a self-help route. So here's the argument the other way. You've got a finding that the court made that there was good evidence of Palestine Action's continuing intention to promote the use of violence regardless of the risk that this will result in serious damage to property or serious violence against members of the public. The criminal law, of course, can deal with crimes which have been committed and also preparation to commit offences in some circumstances, although I'd imagine that's going to be hard to prove. So I think that the government could make the case that criminal law is essentially a reactive measure, which, of course, you can argue also has a deterrent effect. But I think that it would be argued by the government's lawyers that when you're dealing with an organisation highly motivated by its political cause, the question of whether the use of the criminal law is going to actually have a deterrent effect on acts that constitute criminality and or terrorism is doubtful, because it could even be felt that people would not be put off. And then you also have the fact that the criminal process is lengthy and it takes a while for cases to come to trial. So you're quite right. The Court of Appeal might well say that this alternative option means that the measure is disproportionate. But I'm not sure it's clear cut, because I think that it could be that the Court of Appeal says that it was reasonable for the government to consider that the criminal law isn't adequate when you consider the evidence relied on for the events which have already taken place, coupled with the continued motivation. And I've said this already, but I do think it's significant that Palestine Action lauded rather than condemned the acts found to have constituted terrorism. Who knows? I think you're absolutely right to focus on that as being a likely key area, because it could be that the Court of Appeal says the Divisional Court carefully considered this and the reasoning is perfectly adequate to answer why they found it to be disproportionate. On balance, I think that the Court of Appeal may more likely say that the government had reasons why it felt the criminal law wouldn't suffice. It was pursuing a legitimate aim and it was within the range of reasonable options, and therefore, when you consider the margin of discretion, it wasn't disproportionate. And I'll be really interested to see what the outcome is on this and really interested to discuss it with you further.
To add to that, John, not only is the deterrent effect, I think, a very valid consideration, but also, as I mentioned at the beginning, there are some juries that are, you know, refusing to engage with these cases. And we've seen also the publicity that hunger strikers in prison have been given. So I think it's also a question of how criminal proceedings play out. And once people have been charged and are in prison, how that plays out, not least in terms of public sympathies. So I'm sure that if this issue becomes more prominent, that those are also factors that the government may point to in terms of how effective the criminal law is as a tool to meet their objectives. So what next? We're in a funny situation, aren't we? Because Shabana Mahmood has been given permission to appeal as of last week. So we know that an appeal is happening. I suspect the Court of Appeal will want to deal with this quite quickly, because the quashing order of the Divisional Court has been stayed pending that appeal. And operationally, in the meantime, although the Metropolitan Police have said they'd stop arresting people, they haven't released anyone in prison. So we're in limbo, aren't we, until we get the decision at least of the Court of Appeal.
That's exactly right. So I completely agree. I think it would be good to have a decision on this as soon as possible. I mean, of course, this is a highly complex case. The court will need time, but effectively, by maintaining the prescription in place, because the effect of the quashing order was suspended, we are in limbo. And you know, it could well be that the divisional court decision is upheld, or it could be overturned. But either way, clarity would be really helpful so that the police know where they stand. And the police have decided, essentially, they've gone for a kind of halfway house. And I think that it would help everyone to know what the position is. So I don't know what the timetable will be, but I would guess the Court of Appeal would want to hand down a decision as soon as it can and before the end of the year, would be my guess.
There's nothing lawyers like more than clarity. So let's look forward to that. And as John said, once we get a decision of the Court of Appeal, we'll probably be back to discuss that and their reasoning and the consequences of the same. So John, thank you so much for joining me for what was a fascinating discussion. And we'll speak, I'm sure, in the coming months.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been fascinating and I look forward to discussing it further.
Brilliant. If you'd like to get in contact with us about any of the things we've said in the course of this episode, please do write in to the email address in the episode description. And as I said in this episode, please do go and read John's article on the UK Human Rights blog if you would like more detail about the decision. Thank you for joining us.